The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So we're going to be talking today a little bit about about directions of international law in the 21st century, both as a business perspective and as an academic perspective. I'm going to ask Luce to speak for no longer than about 10, 15 minutes each, and we would love to have your input as well about these topics.
Let's go with an intro panel.
Talking that short?
Yeah!
Oh, I know it's painful, but you can do it.
Thank you so much for having me, and some of the points that I'm going to give you all come not only from the academic point of view, but also I have been a consultant in several cases working with many law firms, and when I was asked to participate in this program, I also sent some inquiries to several law firms in Europe and in South America and here in the States to see the flavor that I could get from some of the lawyers that are confronting this very difficult but marvelous task of practicing in the 21st century. And we have a changing world. The law practice must adapt to three moving threads. And I have summarized everything that I said on the following. We have a shift from reason to chaos-based logic. Second, the splintering of social, political, and economic organization as we know it. And third, the collapse of the producer-controlled consumer market and the rise of consumer-controlled markets. Technology is also eliminating the middleman. And I want to give you perhaps some tips as to what I got from all the practitioners. What do law firms need to do? They need to identify new skills. They need to reshape the service portfolio. They need to redesign the process. And they need to renovate resources. There are many current impacts in the legal profession in the 21st century. And I have summarized those impacts as follows. We are living in a borderless world. A world in which now we have not only goods moving back and forth easier, but we also have crime moving back and forth much easier. And we have law firms merging or using the skills of other firms in different parts of the world. Number two, we have technological advances and displacement of traditional skills due to this technology. Third, we have market value shifts. And fourth, leadership is imperative today. Law firms need leaders in charge that are going to adjust themselves to fast trends. We also have a global perspective that is influencing the law firm in the 21st century. And I have these as follows. We have political forces, economic forces, social forces, technological forces, human resources, and regulatory forces. So, how do law firms could maintain competitiveness in a global legal market? They are under pressure from competitors and clients. They are huge law firms that are absorbing, and sometimes they are even excluding certain middle and small law firms from the competition. Law firms must cultivate a heightened responsiveness to changing conditions, rely less on tradition and more on innovation to build viable, profitable practices. They need to recruit and retain legal talent and staffing to meet changing conditions in the legal marketplace. The legal talent today not only needs to be individuals versed in law, but also in technology. They need to be individuals who know how to use not only the legal field, but also other fields. Legal profession today needs to be fed by all fields. Law firms have always faced both operational and staffing challenges. Like today's issues are more complex than ever before. To compete successfully with mega firms, mid-sized firms are forming legal networks that temporarily unite offices in different sites, cities, and countries. A steady exodus of experienced attorneys from large to mid-sized firms. They are driven by attorneys' desire for more leadership opportunities, greater control over their practice areas, increased exposure to business development, or search for better work-life balance. Now, I want to address some issues that are relevant specifically to international practice. And these issues are very important today in the 21st century. Even though we have the technology, we still have different legal systems. And that affects how we deal with the legal practice at the international level today. It is frustration with differences in responsiveness. Sometimes they are culturally based, and the ability for an attorney from another legal system to adapt to different legal concepts from working on cross-border transactions is crucial. There is a need today more than ever for lawyers to try to understand the differences, not only in the words, but in the concepts. Extreme frustration when having to deal with local consular offices. Just because we lack the knowledge on the culture in that place, or we lack the knowledge on that legal system. Coordination between nations and even local authorities on the international scene is difficult to work out due to language barriers, time zones, as well as difference in law and how the violations are viewed in each country. This makes it crucial for the law firms today to perhaps do some training to the lawyers who are handling issues at the international level. Offshore and foreign secrecy in countries is a problem, even with new mutual legal assistance treaties, and even as secrecy barriers are broken down amongst the countries. This is telling the lawyers today that they cannot rely just on mutual legal assistance treaties, but they need to be aware that diplomacy sometimes becomes crucial when you are handling international issues. The media that thrives on controversy and occasionally our advocacy system emphasizes and exaggerates the difference among legal systems, but this behavior distorts the broad trend and the facts on the ground. Procedural differences will take longer to assimilate or may never completely change. But some international in-house counsel see a trend for similarities that perhaps are moving faster than any tendency to differentiate international systems. Dealing with corruption in the international arena, the defense is crucial today. The law firms need to be aware of this, especially because we are using technology and because we are dealing with the world without borders. Different legal systems and theories of law can be a problem in detecting crimes. Different attitudes as to what is illegal may become an issue. Is it right, immoral, or the normal course of doing business in one place versus another place? Does the Foreign Poor Practices Act really work outside the United States? What about OECD? What about OAAs? All these conventions against corruption. Corruption eats at the fabric of any democratic society. The public does not support corruption cases and sees their government as weak. It invites distrust of the government process and lack of respect of its institutions. This situation is rampant in the former Soviet bloc countries, where emerging democracies cannot cope with their corruption issues, and is seen in the Far East also. Does this invite revolution? Maybe for more social change. Law firms that are dealing with these nations need to be aware of this. Corruption has been here and will be here. How much we want to face it and investigate it depends on the society we live in and how much we believe or our institutions can be affected by it. I think law firms have a great task in trying to train their lawyers when they are dealing with different countries and cultures. The impact of 9/11 and the war against terrorism. Law firms today are faced with a lot of changes, especially after 9/11. Regulations impose additional layers of scrutiny on the part of banks, even the legal profession. This requires advanced planning in connection with closing of a deal and with how law firms are going to be handling issues with law firms in different countries. There are certain issues of confidentiality depending on the regulations that each nation will have with regards to due diligence and perhaps even revealing certain facts. Often individuals overseas are not comfortable with providing passport and IDs because they do not understand the United States high level of security. We have a lot of requirements here in the United States. We need to report a lot of things that many other nations are against reporting. Those 9/11 investigative resources and funding has been taken away from fraud and corruption investigations. All of this also is affecting the way we do business in the organization. What about the impact of technology on the 21st century practice? Email. Everyone wants to communicate via email. Well, sometimes email is good for certain things because the transactions are easier and faster, but there are a lot of problems. Language barriers. Sometimes we may think we are communicating properly in an email, but the email method makes it more difficult to have successful negotiations. My time is up. I'll be very happy to answer any questions. Like I said, this is
And apropos just your final comment about emails, for those of you who are following the prosecutor discussions and see what the email traffic is doing to undermine the administration and how the revelation of the email exchanges has had incredible impact, political and legal probably, no doubt about it. Robert?
Yes, thank you very much. Sure. For inviting me to share this panel. I'm a legal practitioner,
traffic flow and business flow in Argentina, and I will make some comments or remarks from my point of view as a practitioner. I will divide my presentation in two parts. First part is I'm going to talk about the forces that are affecting the legal profession nowadays. And in the second part, I will talk about the core values and skills that we need to keep in order to succeed in the years to come. The forces that I see that are affecting the legal profession are the following. As Luz said, well, there are many technological advances. We see each and every day further use of the technological advances and increasingly virtual communications, and there are improved ways of video conferencing systems. There is real integration of the internet into case development, which includes conducting factual and legal research, locating expert witnesses. This serves online live demonstration real scenarios, further development of the electronic filings and digital signature technologies, which are changing the way court cases is conducted. Second, there is, as Luz said, there is a technology displacement, because traditional skills are being replaced by technology. Third, there is a growing commoditization of legal services. There are other professions like accountants and financial planners or professionals that are doing in some way things that lawyers used to do in the past. And it seems that the legal market will be even more open in the years to come to other professions. This causes that as other commodity markets, this causes that as other commodity markets, there will even be more price competitive competition. There is a borderless world. I mean, there is growing outsourcing and offshoring of legal services in a flat and global world. In my experience, for example, I work. I'm attorney to a Canadian company in Argentina, and the Canadian legal department of that company. I mean, it's a telephone or telecommunications company. The inside lawyers. And we, as the outside counsel, we are currently working on a Vietnamese project. I mean, it's a Canadian company, we're in Argentina, and we're working on a Vietnamese project. So, and in the near future, we will be working on a South Africa project. So, when we talk about the borderless work and flat work, we're talking about legal work done in a country like Argentina, or Asia, or for any other continent or country. We noticed too that there is an increasingly dissatisfied client base. The market demands more insightful lawyers with new skills, in-depth expertise, and extraordinary agility. Another point is that some areas of practice are experiencing significant changes and need interdisciplinary partnerships, like genetics, biotechnology, environmental, and gender law. And finally, I'm not trying to cover all the forces, but the one that I think are the most important, finally, the world of commerce is global technological, instantaneous, and increasingly virtual. All these together make us think that there will be important changes in the years to come. And we need to focus on the factors that will enable us to create a viable long-term future for our profession. And in that sense, some of the core values and skills that I think that will help us to succeed in the years to come are the following. Business lawyers need to get away from thinking like lawyers and start thinking like business people. I mean, that's something that in our practice, I always say, I always tell young lawyers to do, because lawyers tend, in practice, especially young lawyers, tend to see all the obstacles to do a transaction. And in some cases, it is important to see the business point of view and try to find solutions in order to get the problem solved and close, you know, transaction. So getting away from thinking like lawyers and start thinking like business people is something that is very, very, very important. Leadership is also very important, as you said. Also, something that I noticed that clients value a lot is availability and accessibility. When a lawyer, say an associate or a partner, in a law firm, I mean, when he is available and accessible, I mean, that's something very valuable for a client. Listening abilities is something that is very, very important. In many cases, I noticed that people don't listen to each other. And that's one of the main problems, you know. When you're a lawyer, you need to listen first to everyone and then speak. Speed, execution, and responsiveness is another very, very important ability. Of course, in-depth expertise, a team approach in which clients have access to more than just the relationship partner is another point that lawyers have to be, in some cases, the relationship partner wants to have exclusive contact with the client. And that's something bad for the client and for the firm and for everyone in the relationship. I mean, clients need to have, you know, relationship with more than the relationship partner. Also, understanding our client's business is very important. Diversity of experience and thoughts must be leveraged. We also have to think about reshaping our services portfolio. That's something we do at least once a year. See which other services can we provide to our clients. Redesigning our processes and redirect our resources. In that sense, lawyers, we tend to be very structured and follow traditions. Think and do things as we used to do in the past. And it is important to have an open mind and try to redesign processes and redirect our resources. And also identify new skills and develop different skills, such as planning skills, technology skills, marketing skills, visioning skills. These abilities and capabilities are very important, especially when you have firms that are growing. In the case in which I can talk, in Argentina, large firms are not so big, and lawyers, well, usually we tend to think like lawyers, and in some cases we have to manage, you know, big groups of people, and
what would a big firm be?
In Argentina, the largest firm has 100 lawyers, but a medium or big, trying to be a big firm, may have from 30 to 50 lawyers. Our firm has 15 lawyers, and I started my firm 6 years ago. And I started with one lawyer, and it grew up to 15 in 6 years. So I was not trying to manage, you know, so many people and to deal with so many operational things, because I used to practice as a lawyer, and that's it. And now I find that every day, you know, I have to deal with human resources, with planning, with marketing, I mean, things that I was not, in which I was not trained. I mean, and I feel more comfortable when I'm dealing with things of our profession, having contact with the client, solving the case, writing, doing some research, writing a memo, writing a contract, and rather than dealing with other people, you know, with human resources, with other things that are more proper of business. So I think that some of the skills that I mentioned are maybe very useful, and this is not, I think it's not only applicable for lawyers that are in fail of being the career in which they have to handle, you know, more lawyers. But in any case, whether you are here in any country, and when you grow, you know, in the firm, you will be handling more people. And these are topics that are not taught in law school, but you will have to handle in the future. But I don't want to take more time.
And for that, I think it would be really useful, given we've had one perspective that suggests that huge law firms are an issue as we go into the 21st century. Greco's identifying that as well. Growth of firms, bigger firms, but not big by comparison with some of the large firms in Europe, maybe in the United States. So in addressing the issue, perhaps you could give us a sense of how that issue is affecting German firms.
Right.
You mean
the size of firms, size of firms, and specialization?
Yeah. In the last couple of years, we actually witnessed quite some sea change in that regard. Many of our major German firms, which used to have about 50 to 150 lawyers on board in each location at least, they were in a sort of merger frenzy the last 10, 15 years, and merged with many of the US or London-based UK firms, and they have now. Both of them have now between 500 and 15 up to 2,000 even lawyers on board. I used to work for Linklaters, for example, and I started in 1992 when I got out from law school, started my legal career, and with Cohn Hoffmann, that was a traditional German firm, about 100 years old. They had about 50 lawyers on board. And at that time, was a huge firm compared to other firms. And they merged, went through various mergers. They are now together with Linklaters. 3,000 lawyers altogether all over the world. But in Germany alone, they have certainly about 600 to 800 lawyers at least, even more probably. There are many other such cases in Germany which certainly showed that the legal industry, so to speak, also had to undergo quite some change in that regard. But at the same time, we have also some smaller practices which are highly regarded. They are very often highly specialized as well. And they cater to more local clientele, but local doesn't mean only private people. It also means the so-called, what we call Mittelstand in Germany, medium-sized companies. These are companies ranging from, let's say, 20 million net sales up to 1 billion or so. They're usually in niche markets, and they are extremely successful in their niche markets. Many people don't know them. I, for example, I used to work for a major German corporation. It's not well known to the public. Its name is Heraeus, H-E-R-A-E-U-S. They make about 10 billion euros, about 13, 14 billion dollar turnover. But it's a company which is well known in the industry, but not well known to the general public. And they have more than 200 subsidiaries all over the world. And we have quite a few of these, very often family-owned businesses, which are very successful in their markets worldwide. And the legal industry has some sort of has to try actually to cope with that new development. The last couple of years, we had to get some size on the one side, on the other side, and also to get more specialized, more catered to such a Mittelstand or medium-sized client field. So we have to some extent the same changes in Europe, or in Germany especially, which only happens more or less all over the world.
Thank you.
I have presentation. And I was told that it would be handed out to the colleagues who are interested in actually, so I won't bore you with a lot of statements in there. You have to read it afterwards. I'm very much happy if you're interested in it. But I would just like to pick up on some of these issues.
Sure.
And try to not for more than 10 to 15 minutes. I just wanted to pick up a couple of issues that I think there are some changes. I mean, one is, for example, in the national arena, the national, transnational, and also supranational organizations play now a much more important role in the our world than they used to do or to be 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that changed also to quite some extent how legal business has to be done nowadays. In Germany, for example, as you might recall, Germany is a member state, one of the founding members of the European Union. And the European Union now accounts for about 60-70% of our at least business-related legal body in Germany, meaning regulations and other sorts of legal regulations. The European Union affects the German legal body tremendously, 60-70%, as I said. And there are many other areas which are more affected as well, meaning a German lawyer or a French lawyer, an Italian lawyer, a Spanish lawyer, and all the other jurisdictions, they have to have some understanding of what European law means, and not only have some knowledge about the organization, how law is being set into act, being enacted, and all that sort of things, but also the substantive law of the human law, which more and more affects the German or French or Italian rather legal jurisdictions. And therefore, I think it's very important that people come to the S, come to the W, Washington College of Law, actually, and to get exposure to many other jurisdictions, to national law, to U.S. law and other jurisdictions, in order to more in a position to really understand what it means to be, like we Germans or French people or other colleagues, part of the European Union, which affects us tremendously in legal matters. That's one issue I would like to stress. And then we have the another matter, which is different in all other jurisdictions, but there are some tendencies at least which have some impact on how we do our legal business. It's the health and social security business. I think here we also witness major challenges worldwide due to an increasing population and also a shift in population structure, become older, and there are some organizational structural changes, and the laws and regulations are very intense in that field. So it's only for specialists possible anymore to really understand what's going on there. And I think that's also a field that I can only pick up on it for a few seconds, actually, or a few minutes. But I think that's also an area which becomes more and more important in the future in the US, in Europe, in Asia, and other places in the world, where we need highly qualified lawyers who are interested in this area, and which also becomes more and more international, because we all have to learn from each other. How do the US try to cope with these problems? How do we as Germans try to cope with? And there are still many differences, but in the long run, I think we also have to try to learn how other jurisdictions try to cope with these issues. And we need lawyers who are able to get into that matter and really, you know, dig big holes and try to understand it and really also influence how we set up these health and social security issues in the future. Then we have the multinational corporations. That's why I was sort of grown up for quite some time. I think corporate governance and corporate social responsibility are major issues. They are at the forefront also in the newspapers, also in the general newspapers, and they certainly play a very important role. And it's very important to have that, certainly for the major corporations. We all know the history of Enron, for example, or WorldCom, or other major companies, which were in quite some trouble, and not only in the US, but also in other jurisdictions where these issues more or less intense. And many of these national and large multinational organizations, they are now in legal battles because of infringements of international trade rules, for example, or patent laws, and or fraud, embezzlement, and many other things. And they have to face up to severe and costly damage compensation claims in many cases, and even imprisonment in some rather rare, but still quite some cases. And they have risk to incur a loss of reputation, which also can be very cost effective for these companies in the long run at least. And I think here it's very important that we have lawyers who are able to cope with these issues, and also from a business perspective, as Alberto mentioned, rightly mentioned, so in fully agree with that statement. It's very important that lawyers who on the one side are well trained in legal matters and substantive law, procedural law, and many other issues, on the other side who are the business acumen as well and understand how businesses work and to what extent they have to be regulated, but not over-regulated. It doesn't make any sense if we have a huge bureaucracy set up in these companies, which doesn't give them any freedom anymore of business judgments and business decisions, which can sometimes fail. And I think it's very important that highly well-trained, very loyal level in these companies, with also business acumen, who are able to set up structures to advise from business and legal perspective. These are also areas which I think will grow in the future, in the immediate future, and also in the long run, and will become more and more important. Last point to stress in that regard is hedge funds and private equity. I mean, the US is very experienced in that regard, that the Germans or the Europeans, they were, at least up to about 5 years ago, were not that didn't know that much about hedge funds, about private equity. But now it plays in Europe a very, very important role. Many US hedge funds and private equity institutions are acquiring companies, medium and large sized companies to an extent as well. And I think that's also another issue where lawyers are very, very important to accompany these M&A transactions, which are usually of high complexity, and to accompany them not only from a legal perspective, but also again from a business perspective. Are real business partners really valuable counterparts to their business colleagues who accompany them in these transnational, in all cases, transnational and highly complex structures? That's certainly a field, I think, which will gain in further importance and will be a major area where we, as lawyers, can have quite some influence. There are some other issues which I can touch upon afterwards. What I would like to stress as well is the ethics and values in the national practice, not only in national laws, in domestic practice, but it also plays quite some importance, or has also some importance in international practice. And they are even more important in a globalized economy, where it is not always clear what ethics and values actually mean. I mean, there are divergent opinions on what that means. And once you mentioned that aspect also, I can also stress the importance, as you did. It's very important. It's certainly much easier to putting ethics into writing than actually putting ethics into practice. That's a challenge we always have to face. Everybody has to face, not only in the legal field, but as lawyers, I think we have to be some sort of role model for our people. We can't live ethically. How can we expect our people are able to live ethically in the business world? So that's an important issue, I think. And lawyers require a really solid grounding in both understanding of the law's moral compass, which I think is very important, but also resolve modern day affairs like conflicts of interest and trust fund usage. And especially conflict of interest is something you mentioned indirectly on that as well. The larger company law firm gets, actually, the more important it is to be really very sensitive on that issue and to understand what is meant for, actually. And lawyers should know their code of professional conduct like preachers, knowing their holy books, check the verse. That, I think, is also important, not just to talk about, but to...
Yeah, our Bible.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And there are further core values, I think, which are vital for the clients of all lawyers. That's the commitment to the independence of lawyers and the legal profession, which is contested more and more. There's, I think, a commitment to preservation of client content, which is very important. A prohibition against conflicts of interest, as I mentioned, legal profession is also vital core. A maintenance of high ethical standards. And when we come back to the large organizations, certainly multinational organizations, I think large organizations depend heavily on people who have a very, very high ethical standard. Because whatever system you implement, to avoid people from embezzling money or from, you know, graft or whatever means, you can do that, but it's very complicated. It requires a lot of resources. It's by far better to recruit people who already bring on board a high ethical standard, you know, or high ethical consciousness. And these people will make sure, wherever they work, that they that they comply with these ethical standards that will hopefully get at least also help to establish a climate, a culture within the corporation that things we knew from anyone or many other companies will not occur anymore. Because that's not something the Attorney General or the jurisdictions or the judges and all these very important people can't guarantee. You know, it's the people who have to guarantee, and I think it's very important to attract such people. I would like to just touch upon a couple of these conclusions, and then I would allow Richard to open up for this discussion. Just a few thoughts again on the some major conclusions. First one is, in my opinion, globalization affects not only economies and nation states, but also people and the law itself. The law can play a major role in structuring and influencing and establishing a world we just talked about. The law must take an actively shaping force in the changes ahead. It should not be limited to a neuron adapting to those changes. We should be at the forefront of development and not just running after our business colleagues and other colleagues and then try to come up with systems to more or less get it structured. Third conclusion, we must all as lawyers and business professionals constantly learn and adapt. That was a theme our other colleagues mentioned as well. I think it's very important, constant learning and adapt to new circumstances and keep up with general and also legal developments. And education and constant learning becomes the key in the future. That's why it's so important to have great institutions like WCL and some others who really express this issue. And not only from a legal point of view, not only from a business point of view, but also from a human rights point of view. I think it's very, very important, becomes more important in the future, to have people, even though they work in the business environment, to have some sort of legal grounding also in the humanitarian field. Conclusion four, there's an increasing demand for highly educated and devoted lawyers with not only legal knowledge, just one already, and as human, but also with a broad general knowledge, not only confined to legal issues, but really a broad understanding, ethical issues, values, but business, and many other follow-up things, to be really a good counterpart in all these things. Lawyering and business, we talked about already, becomes more and more intertwined. Excellent lawyers must have a good understanding of business and its strategic and operative issues. As we mentioned about how a large law firm should be structured, I mean, I see there also some sort of development which comes from the business front, so to speak, you know, to really get the processes within a law firm more or less restructured, redone, to make it more effective, more efficient. These are all things which come from the business world, but they play a more and more important role in the setup and structuring of especially large law firms. And six top law schools like the Washington College of Law play a major role in the education and training of young and increasingly of senior lawyers, not just young lawyers, but we also take on board more experienced senior lawyers, train them as well in human rights law, in environmental law, and many other areas. I think that's also something which becomes more and more important. And not only in the US, but totally all over the world. And final point, seven, there is no specific area of law, I would say, which will flourish by all means, which will really lead the pack, so to speak, than others. But there are certain tendencies, at least. International law certainly plays a very, very important role in all areas. Business law, human rights law, I mentioned already. Immigration law is also a major issue. It's not at the forefront of many of the students, but it's an important law, actually. National finance law, we talk about hedge funds and private equity institutions, mergers and acquisitions, real estate becomes also more and more national. We need people who are strong in these areas as well. Intellectual property law, there was one out of the conference yesterday I attended. It was a great panel, actually, on intellectual property law. There's also an area, environmental law, and certainly health law, which we discussed. Well, thank you very much. Education, I think, is also the ability to listen to almost anything without losing your temper and your self-confidence and so on. Very grateful.
Power is so for one and three of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I am just thrilled with these presentations. I'm sorry we couldn't have made your presentations in a larger session with a larger audience. I'm deeply appreciative that we have those who are here, but these are just incredibly helpful and insightful, I think, presentations. And I want to commend each of you. I think there are some themes that that resonate through all of the presentations that I want to both just take a minute to draw some of those together and maybe point to some of the other broader themes and maybe kind of come full circle with Luz's opening remarks, and then start with a question to her, and then open it up to the floor. I think because because two of our panelists are involved in the business world of law practice, we get a wonderful perspective on what it means for law practice now and law practice in the future in the field of business. I think some of the implications that are there that I want to offer to the audience, to the panelists, as thoughts for this future direction might point towards the extent to which corporations have become or are headed towards becoming a substitute for the state and corporate dimensions, multinational power, financial power, and the firms that work with multinational corporations in the breathtaking way that Alberto describes in your own work with a Canadian firm that has implications in other parts of the world have enormous implications on state power and what we see as the parallel direction that Luz alluded to with regard to the decline of sovereignty, the erosion of traditional norms of international law that make the borderless world so much more real today in terms of both its advantages for business and its disadvantages, I might point to, for countries that are still in development or are actually sliding backwards in the development scale. And you might look prominently at Africa in that regard, some parts of Asia, while other parts of Asia, China and India, rocket forward, other parts slip into relative decline. And some parts of Latin America, I think that is true as well. So the flat world that we imagine is real, and globalization benefits most of us, but we still struggle with the Millennium Development Goals of the UN and the issues for women in poverty, particularly, and issues of development versus developing world and what the implications are for that structurally and otherwise. We also have heard very little mention today of structures that are probably the most used by the students who participate in my own clinic, and those are students who come with an idealistic view of what they want to do for law in the service of people who are otherwise not represented in the legal system, and who tend to move more towards the NGO world, and in their work either in the United States with multinational human rights organizations, or in small, agile NGOs, such as those that Alejandro works with in Ecuador and others that you have worked with in other countries around the world. The challenges for the big international organizations like the UN, the OAS, the African Union, the entities whose charge is to deal with these issues, I think, are enormous and not necessarily easy in a world that is dominated right now by a relatively hegemonic view of the world in which the UN does not play as important a role as it probably should. You alluded to immigration, and I think the issues, the related issues with development and developing world have a lot to do with the role of forced migration, the ways that market forces draw or pull or push populations from the developing world into the developed world. And many of the issues that have been so prominent in U.S. discussion, but certainly in Europe,
have to do with this creation of markets and labor movements and the difficulties we encounter with immigration and the very much related issue that you spoke so well with regard to our conflict and the issues of crime across borders. I think we see at the same time the direction of both smaller local ethnic conflicts, armed conflicts, destabilized governments, and this counter-phenomenon of the huge so-called war on terror that affects us all in the way that we think about both crime and war and what its implications are for law enforcement that are not so prominent when we think about business, but are implicit, and I want to close with this. I think your invocations, both of your strong invocations of issues of values and ethics, I think are so important throughout and run throughout all of this discourse. So that when we think about the implications for the next century, we are talking about a commonly shared sense of values that exalt fairness over corruption and good business practices over bad business practices that tend to undermine the ability of businesses to do their work. So I was fascinated. Luce, you started, and this is where I want to open up the discussion. You started, and it went by so fast that I want to go back and grab it. You said your very first point was that we're moving from a reason-based to a chaos-based world. Say some more about that. What do you mean by reason-based to chaos-based?
You know, and I wanted, like, when I mentioned 9/11,
yeah,
and the impact of 9/11, that's what I meant. Prior to 9/11, it was easier for lawyers and law firms to think about certain issues. And it was easy to make deals. All of a sudden, we got 9/11, and perhaps, like many say, the obsession with terrorism, or perhaps how many countries are dealing with internal conflict, and we are labeling a lot of groups as terrorist groups. Well, that has created some type of chaotic environment for law firms. And I think that is here to stay. What we had after 9/11 and for the business world, for the business lawyers, is the reality. We have the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act has made a lot of things more difficult. And to many, especially in the legal profession, a little bit chaotic. Transferring funds is more difficult with the Patriot Act. Not only transferring funds, there is a lot of scrutiny with the type of money that is being paid to lawyers also. So lawyers and the legal profession today need to be more careful about who is my client. So all of a sudden, we were able to relax in the legal profession, and we feel that perhaps there is a sense of chaos. And once again, that is here to stay. And that is going to require from law firms, big, small, whatever size you have, more advanced planning in connection with perhaps closing of deals or in connection with who is paying me and how is this payment coming? Should I check export controls? I mean, that is the requirement that lawyers have now. And the European community, due diligence. The European community through the International Bar Association is looking into this new imposition of confidential regulations in the legal profession. And these mega firms that before were relaxed, you know, now it's like, how are we going to deal with these new sets of regulations? Because because after 9/11, all of a sudden, whoa, we needed to reveal certain things, but that is going against our confidentiality rules that we have, as we had known it prior to 9/11. So that's pretty much all.
All right. Let me, do we have questions from Alejandro?
One of the things that I see in this borderless world is that we, at least in Latin America, we don't have laws created for a borderless world. And our education becomes an obstacle for practicing law. As Alberto said, when we hire a new lawyer, this lawyer is trained to work with basically domestic law, domestic issues, and not considering that law is not domestic anymore. And probably that reshaping law schools, at least in Latin America, is one of the biggest challenges that we have for practicing law in the 21st century. Like, I don't know if you have seen this in your practice, but at least in my practice, in both sides, as a legal practitioner has, and I see it as a big challenge. Particularly considering the way that we teach law in Latin America, and the way that traditional professors work in Latin America, teaching the
Argentina, the government is trying to make a judicial reform, and this project started, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and the project has not been successful. And the reason why is because they didn't start from law school. And I think that any judicial reform that any country would like to make should start from law school. I mean, you need to wait a whole generation to pass the change in order to make such structural reforms. And in that sense, I totally agree with you. I mean, we need to, first of all, we need to change curricula, maybe wait, for new professors. In the meanwhile, what we can do, is prepare,
I mean,
it's hard to change, you know, a guy who is, I don't know, maybe 60 years old, who has been in practice, or who is the judge, to make he or she change the way he or she thinks. So the easiest way is to start, young people.
No doubt about it. I think it's a great question, Alejandra, and I think it's true. And Winfred had wonderful things to say about WCL and control. I think we all appreciate it. I know Professor Bradlow would love to hear adulation, which Winfred calls the WCL ILSP program.
Hey, 1 minute too late.
1 minute too late. Never too late. Never too late. But I bet Luce would share my view that if we, one of the big changes in the U.S. would be to add international law to the bar.
Yes.
Let's put it on the bar exam so that the lawyers have to know it, or at least to have to pass through that portal in order to be able to be competent practitioners. I've been saying to my own students for the last decade, and I'll bet you have to yours as well, that I don't believe a student who's interested in these fields of human rights can be a competent practitioner without having an adequate base of training in international law. But many schools, I think Europe has done a lot with that, with integration on thinking about both transnational law and international law. But the United States is a huge country that sees itself as hegemonic, if I may use the term. This spring, for example, I was mentioning to the panelists that I'm teaching a new course in our first year. For the first time, we're offering a course to our first-year students as an elective. Many of them, because of the school and because of the wonderful work we've done in international law, including this program, I think gave an indication before they had an option for this elective that they wanted to take something dealing with international law. So we're offering a very large section on public international law with about 80 students in the first year. And I'm teaching a course called International law gets incorporated into the United States. In many ways, I see it as a reflection of the same kind of challenge as you described, undoubtedly, that occurs in the law schools in Ecuador and throughout Latin America, of thinking about how to incorporate international law. From a distance, I see countries like Argentina, I see strong participation in the University of Buenos Aires every year in the Moot Court Competition year, and the wonderful decisions from many of the courts in Argentina that have been very progressive in the area of international law, but they are small steps in the direction of thinking and applying international law at the domestic level, which is really, in my view, where the action is. It's about how we take these international law norms that we all study and then take them home in that still jealously guarded sovereignty of each of our countries and say, it means something here as well. And it has implications, as we heard every panelist say. It's where we're headed. It's the direction we're going. We have to pay attention. So, other questions? Yes. Could you say who you are?
Graduate of this program from 2004. I work on humanitarian rights.
Where you're from?
France. Now that I have the exterior look on the country, I'm very surprised still at the divorce between education and cultivating, the divorce between thinking and practice. It's really two completely separate tracks, and I'm interested in getting your opinion maybe on how. What can the industry do to communicate better with the academic world and to make known their what they require of people? Because then there's no dialogue really between. And I see my country anyway, and I mean.
You say industry. What do you mean by industry? You mean business? The business world?
Business.
The firm.
How?
I think you're completely right. I think it's a problem which is not confined to, but what you will witness more in Europe, in Germany, for example, or France. They have several institutions which are, at least most of them, from a theoretical point of view, have great standards, great interpretation in what their professors do there in terms of academic achievement. But it's not that important, at least for the recruiting of professors with any professional background in the field, actually outside the academic world. That's I would say confined to Europe, but it's specific. Characteristic or feature of German education, of French education in France or in other major places in Europe, and perhaps to some extent in Asia as well. I don't know doing that well there. It's much different in the US. I mean, here with what I see here, Danny, with the amount of practitioners and residents you have here, with the amount of action faculty you have here, that's something which I at least don't know of any German institution or any French institution, at least not to that extent. It changed a little bit the last couple of years. That, I think, is a characteristic, a very good feature, what I saw at the WCL. That's great, I think. You have to consult, combine at least, or try to bring together both worlds, because it's very important in the training of people, especially on the graduate level, that they get some exposure to the outside world, so to speak. Yeah, that's great.
Sure, please.
I think that this goes for both of you, for Alejandro and for you. I think that the role of the bar associations in your own nations becomes crucial, because it's not just coming from the law school per se, but I think that once lawyers graduate and they're practicing, there is a need for the bar associations to communicate with the law schools and perhaps try to bring together practitioners and also students and professors to try to say, look, we need to work together in something more practical, like this university has in place. You have a lot of professors who are working as consultants and doing a lot of pro bono on crucial cases. That flavor of real world practice brought not only into a law school environment, but also CLE, continuing legal education, is going to bring practitioners, professors, and students together. and perhaps that's going to bring more of the reality into the world of students that sometimes are still in touch.
I think it's it is, Gilbert is right that it will take a generation. This is a long, gradual process. I don't think it's a coincidence, and I think Winfred points to this, that when we look at the way that clinical English, practical training, the integration of practical training while in law school, that it's at least the idea behind the traditional apprentice system of Europe and Latin America and a lot of areas of the world, that the apprenticeship system has eroded and become something vastly different than what it was designed to be many years ago, in my view. So that the training of lawyers for practice, the integration of practice and theory while in law school, I think has taken off as an innovation in legal education throughout the world, except Western Europe. So that the last bastion of resistance is in countries like France, Germany, where the process of becoming an academic is so ingrained in history and in tradition and in non-practice, that is, one becomes known as an academic because of your stellar writing and your production of a thesis and your production of written work that requires all of your attention and energy rather than practice. And I think Winfred's exactly right when he says that there is something different here that is going on, that's trying to look at how to integrate those two areas of theory and practice. It's certainly what both of you talk about when you talk about the business world and the preparation for practice are the kinds of things that we try to teach in our practice, whether it's in human rights or not. It's about having a client. It's about figuring out what you're going to do when you go into practice and thinking about the values you want to reflect in your professional practice. And that's whether or not you're in the left or the right politically, whether you're in business or NGO world, whether you're in government or private practice, all of those kinds of values, I think, are things that we want to reflect on and think about.
I hesitate to jump in because I've missed most of the conversation, but I think one of the benefits of having LLM students in the program is that if you mix LLM and JD students, what the LLM students often bring into the classroom is that they've had a few years of practical experience. And so the kinds of questions they ask and the way they look at a problem is much more practical and very different from the way a student who's got only an academic training brings in. But what practitioners lose often is because when you're in practice, you focus on whatever the particular problem that you have to deal with for your client is. You don't get to see the whole picture. And if you're learning a field, you learn little bits and pieces according to the needs of your client. And what students often, the JD students can bring, is asking the kinds of fundamental questions that help you understand the whole field in a more coherent way. And so that you get a much richer dialogue by having both groups of students in the class, to the benefit of us, your academics as well.
Absolutely.
Because no matter how much pro bono work you do, you're never as engaged in the world of practice as an academic as you would be if you were truly a practitioner.
I think that's true both with the seminars we offer in the upper class, where we have a good deal of mixture of the JD and LLM groups in. I certainly have. I'm always thrilled to have a large number of LLMs in the enrollment because it brings a global perspective to. And usually, it's because of the sort of profile of our students. It's people who have been in practice or done some things after graduation from their home countries and then come to study here. So it's wonderful to have that. We have it now, even with the dual degree program. So that in the first year elective course that I described, I have a French student who has finished her studies in France and is now in her first year, but she's actually in her fifth year of law study in the law school here. And I think the other day we were talking about the French procedure. I turned to her and said, what's going on in French procedure? She said, I have no idea. I'm just very, 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 very formal. She's aware of them. We didn't get an answer on that one, but oftentimes she's been a wonderful person. So it's and I think it's more an indication of this borderless world that all of you alluded to, and the need for us to have this, another common theme is this need to have skills that are far beyond the legal training we get. So that you need the business skills, you need the ability to think across disciplines well beyond law to think about what the future we hold. Other questions? Yes?
I'm Olga Rudan, graduated class of 2003 and currently with the American Bar Association of Law Initiative in Washington.
Where are you from?
Ukraine, originally.
Okay.
Actually, you know, not so much a question, but just a follow-on to your comment about the need for the bar associations at the local level to work together with the law schools, the faculty, kind of like providing for opportunities for COE. I guess in a lot of the countries that the Global Law Initiative works at, and it's mainly countries in the former Soviet bloc and to some extent in Asia and the Middle East. The challenge in many of those countries is that there is no functioning bar association, so there is just a lot of competing entities. And the challenges are often sometimes the law specifically prohibits the creation of associations, or the government would not recognize the political capability of associations. So I guess that's also important. An important component of these programs is to try to, talk about, like, for students to have the opportunity to talk about best practices in this area in their countries, so that then when they go back, they can bring that into the discussion. We tried to actually help several countries set up independent functioning bar associations, and we ran into problems of, having a group of lawyers locked in a room, trying to have them elect their leadership only. Happen
and
say the government saying don't recognize this association, and it's all coming from.
Yeah, and I know where you're coming from, because I'm working with the ABA on, we just finished a white paper on corruption and the rule of law in the world.
We're
supposed to be presenting that pretty soon in the United Nations. And yes, that was one of the issues that we brought. There's a lot of frustration, especially from Eastern Europe. And one of the things that we have spoken and suggested with this borderless world is it's going to take time. But the fact that you are working in this wonderful group is going to help influence courts. And the European community becomes crucial in that role, because all these nations want to become part of the European community at one point. And that could be one of the issues that can be forward.
Exactly.
We can just keep it. But yeah, that is a working process. But the fact that has been mentioned and is out there, it is.
All right, I think our time is up. I want to give thanks to all of you, all three of you, for your wonderful presentation. Let's join in giving them a round of applause.